Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Silman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions regarding your health and well-being. And really, that's the most important thing we could be doing. You know, it's not about telling anybody what to do. It's providing people with information, with facts, with knowledge, and from there, we are all responsible for making our own decisions in life, but you have to get the whole story in order to make the best decisions and the best path for your health and well-being. So thank you for joining my community. By the way, if you'd like to get the archived shows, please go to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, or you can go to my website, drcherylselman.com, because I can then just email the archived shows to you along with other ongoing information and blogs and research to support you on this journey of true empowerment. So I'm going to jump right into our conversation today because it is so important, and I am so looking forward to this conversation. We're going to be exploring the warning about how our modern world is threatening our fertility and sterility. It's a huge issue, and my guest is Dr. Shauna Swan, who is really beating the drum and going around the world alerting people to this huge problem. And we're going to explore exactly what the problem is, all the ramifications, and most importantly, we're going to be giving you some practical steps and solutions to support your health, well-being, and fertility and sterility. So let me just say a little bit about Dr. Swan. Dr. Shauna Swan is a PhD, is one of the world's leading environmental and reproductive epidemiologists and a professor of environmental medicine and public health at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York City. An award-winning scientist, her work examines the impact of environmental exposures, including chemicals such as phthalates and bisphenol A, on men's and women's reproductive health and the neurodevelopment of children. She is the author of Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. Wow, so this really is a topic near and dear to my heart, and it's a message that we really need to be sharing and getting out into the world. So I'm just so grateful and so honored that Dr. Shauna Swan can be with us today. So hello and welcome, Dr. Swan.
Thank you, Cheryl, and I'm really glad to be on your program and talk to the many followers you have and hopefully make them aware of the problem that I've written about. So we can all do something about it.
So, you know, I was sharing with you before we got onto the podcast that I have been drawn to educating and empowering women for so many years now about hormonal health and well-being. And in the research that I did, I came upon the hormone disruption, the endocrine disrupting hormones, the consequences that were happening. We were seeing in the animals, in the fish. And as I was mentioning to you, I was lecturing all over the country in Australia and meeting people who were sharing with me the manifestations of this disruption from, you know, the hypospadias in young males to adults who felt that their gender was affected or their chromosomes were affected. So this was on my radar screen over 20 years ago, and I know it's been on your radar screen. So the first question I have for you is, what was it that brought you and your attention to this issue that has become such a passion for you and a mission for you in your life?
Yeah, so if we go back to the late 1990s, I was brought onto a committee of the National Academy of Sciences. And that committee was empowered to investigate whether hormone disruptors, endocrine disruptors, actually impacted human health. At that point, it wasn't clear whether it did or they did or didn't, right? And so that's what we were there to do. And as part of that discussion, the committee wanted to consider a paper that had come out just a few years before that. It came out of Copenhagen, first first author Elizabeth Carlson, last author Neil Skekebeck, and that paper claimed that sperm count had declined significantly worldwide. And I was asked by the committee, with my background in statistics, to review that and let the committee know whether they should consider this and whether this was a concern. Okay? So I looked at it and I told them my first opinion was that it was probably not going to hold up under scrutiny. And of course, there are so many things that could explain a decline in sperm count. For example, the way you counted sperm might have changed over time so that later sperm counts were, you know, you're using a method that counted lower. Or maybe the men who were brought into the studies had changed over time. So the men in later studies tended to be less fertile. Or maybe they were more obese. Or maybe they smoked more or whatever. So these factors didn't seem to have been considered in this 1992 paper. So I thought, okay, I can look at this. And I did. I took 6 months and I went into the 61 studies that these authors had used. And I looked for all of those factors, everything anyone had ever suggested that might make sperm count appear to have declined. And I did a big analysis. And when I was all done, the decline had not changed at all. Not at all. It made no difference. So that meant that this decline was not due to bias and confounding, which are two things that we epidemiologists love to look for. Well, at that point, I had to take it seriously because I'd put a lot of time in and I'd also gotten pretty concerned about it because if it was real, the chances are it was going on right then. And since it was too fast to be genetic, by the way, it had to be environment. So I began to believe that environment could adversely affect sperm count, semen quality, and I spent the next 20 years looking at this question. So that was my introduction.
Wow. So this really became, as you investigated it, you saw the reality of a problem that most people were not yet aware of, but yet it was a huge problem. I mean, it's a global problem right now. So what is it that you have come to the conclusion of what the focus of your book is? What is going on with the reproductive health of women as well as men?
That's right. So as we say in Countdown and describe in detail, these problems are not limited to sperm count. In men, there are many other male problems, including lower testosterone and birth defects of the kind you described, hypospadias, cryptorchidism, testicular cancer is going up, erectile function dysfunction is going up, erectile function is going down. And then in women, there's increases in miscarriage and egg depletion and the quality of the eggs and difficulty of couples to actually conceive using assisted reproduction. So this whole body of endpoints seems to have been getting worse, if you will, deteriorating. And the rate is interestingly all about 1% per year. So what I think is going on, and we have to go into detail about this, is that there are actually two sort of big categories of causes of this. And one is our lifestyle, behaviors and factors that we can go into. And the other is chemicals in the environment. And these are not the same, although our lifestyle does affect the chemicals in the environment that we allow into our body. So there's an interaction between these two, but I think these are two separate things we can discuss, you know, one and then the other. So you decide what you want to talk about first.
Okay. So I think before we go and looking at some of the factors that are driving this, can you help us understand why this is such a profound crisis happening right now? When we talk about low sperm counts and we talk about compromised fertility, why is this of such concern to you? And then we'll look at the drivers for that.
Sure. So, first of all, the declines in reproductive function that I've studied all these years and that are documented in Countdown are very profound, and they affect, in some sense, all of our life. For example, men who have low sperm count or who are infertile go on to have more heart disease, more diabetes, more cancers, particularly reproductive cancers, and to die younger. So you see there, that plays out over the whole lifetime, and in women as well. Women who are infertile have problems later in life of many kinds, including increased reproductive cancers and also earlier mortality. So we like to say the reproductive health is the sixth vital sign, that it's something that we should be paying attention to early in life, so that the same way we pay attention to blood pressure and cholesterol, you know, they're going to tell us something about the disease that's coming up and maybe our lifespan. So this is really profound on a personal level. And then on a societal level, as we have observed the pyramid, the demographic pyramid, which should be having a very wide base, lots of young people and fewer older people, is shifting. What that means is that there's fewer and fewer babies being born, people are living longer, and this whole pyramid is inverted. And what that means is that the people under 65 are not going to be available to support the people over 65. And for a society, this spells real serious trouble. So that's another major implication. Another implication is that the changes that we're bringing about through the exposures that we're going to talk about are not just changes to our health, they're also changes to our children's health and even our grandchildren and later generations' health. So we're looking at something that spins out for many generations. And for all of these reasons, these are very, very profound changes.
You know, I became aware of this when I was investigating the DES story, this diacetyl terbestrial story, when they were giving high levels of an estrogen to help, they thought, prevent women from miscarrying. Actually, my aunt was on that and gave birth to my cousin who had club feet as a birth defect. And that, so there are about three generations now that have been affected by that initial exposure that perhaps their grandmother had, and we're still seeing that hormone and that DNA damage affecting the reproductive health of their children, grandchildren, men and women, or deformities happening. I mean, there's all sorts of manifestations when we start messing from exposure to chemicals and inappropriate hormones, and you know the reproductive system is so delicate. And we can see long-term consequences.
I'm so glad you brought up DES because it's so important to our whole field of you know, environmental health and endocrine disruption. It's, if you will, was perhaps the first well-studied endocrine disruptor. And it also taught us about delayed effects. Of course, you know that, but your listeners might not, that the mother was exposed, and the first harm that was demonstrated was in the daughters when they were teenagers. That's a long delay. And when before the product was widely marketed, the drug companies gave it to a bunch of physicians and said, is this safe? And the physicians looked at the offspring at birth and said, yes, they're great. They're fine. There's no problem. And of course, they were wrong. So we've learned about these delayed effects, transplacental carcinogenesis, the effects of hormone disruption. It was the first example. And I think it's, and the other thing that's very profound about it is that it showed that the fetus is exquisitely sensitive to this exposure. The mothers themselves, who took tons of this drug, were not heavily affected, but the offspring were.
And you know, the irony of that whole story was that DES never really prevented miscarriages.
Right.
That's the, you know, the sad irony of it all. So let's talk about hormone disruption, because that's really what is driving these manifestations of behaviors and imbalances. So let's go into hormone disrupting chemicals, the hormone disrupting process, so people really understand that the exposure that we have in our environment, in the greater environment, in our own internal environment, in the external environment, it's definitely creating hormone disruption, and we're a manifestation of that environment.
Right. So what we're talking about, as you know, Cheryl, is the class of chemicals that have the ability to alter our body's natural hormones. And so that's lots and lots of hormones. But the ones that are most critical for reproduction are the steroid hormones, and particularly those that can interfere with androgen and estrogen production, transport, and so on. So I've spent most of my time researching this field, looking at a class of chemicals called phthalates, which have the ability to disrupt, to interfere with androgens, and they lower the body's natural androgens, and the consequences are very profound, particularly for males. And if you want, we can talk about those effects. But there are others, for example, well, DES was one, but now that's no longer on the market for use in pregnancy. But bisphenol A is a lookalike, if you will, another very potent estrogen, which is on the market and is in, you know, baby bottles and makes plastic hard. Phthalates make plastic soft. So, you know, whenever you see a soft plastic, think phthalates. When you see a hard plastic, you think BPA. But they're both extremely damaging to our body's natural hormones, and both can severely damage our reproductive systems.
So, well, you know, I think looking at this, the hormone disruption is so important. And, you know, I was shocked. You know, you think of bisphenol A in those plastic bottles. Once exposed to heat, it can leach into the whatever the liquid is. But I also learned that we have exposure of this primary, this major hormone-disrupting chemical from the receipts you get from supermarkets and stores, that process, to that heat process creates it. And in the protection, they put on children's teeth to protect them from cavities when they're very young. Is made right. with bisphenol A, and the lining of tin cans, all tin cans are lined with bisphenol A.
Yeah, so you talk about the receipts. So dermal absorption of these chemicals is really important. People, I think, mostly think about ingestion, but dermal absorption is really important too for bisphenol A, for all of these chemicals. Phthalates are chemicals that make increase absorption. So they're in our cosmetics, they're in our, you know, skincare products, and they also increase retention of color and scent. And so they're put in hairspray, and they're put in nail polish and lipsticks. And so we get them from all over the place. And then in our house dust, we're inhaling them. So we get inhalation, we get dermal absorption, we get ingestion, and actually food is the major source of exposure to most of these chemicals.
Wow. So I know that in the very beginning, when people were starting to see something terribly wrong going on, it was through looking at environmental factors and the sex changes that were happening and amphibians or fish. So can we start there, what was observed, and then we can move into how it's moving into the human population? But it wasn't that like the first place that was observable of these sex changes or behaviors changing
yeah.
in animals?
So fish and frogs and reptiles were very good sentinels of early damage. And Lou Gillette reported, of course, you know, that alligators were being born with very small genitalia, small penises. Tyrone Hayes reported that frogs were being born with ovaries and testes in the same animal, in the same frog. There were many studies in fish showing feminization of fish exposed to endocrine disruptors. So the changes were both in terms of ability to reproduce and also in terms of gender, disorders of sexual development.
And that was from all the chemicals that were being leached into the environment and into the lakes and rivers that these animals were living in. So even though there were tiny amounts, right, they weren't high. I mean, it's not like you have to have tons of exposure. You just have, hormones are just made in parts per million, parts per billion. Just small amounts can have drastic alterations in normal function.
That's very surprising, and it also has big implications for regulation because we know, for example, that the sex of the co-twin in utero affects the development of the other twin. And the differences in hormone levels between the male-male twin and the male-female twin are very, very slight. And there was a lot of beautiful work done early in the 80s showing that in rodents who were, they have a big litter, right? So they're all in this uterine horn together, and a male could be between two males or between two females. And depending on the sex of the neighbor, the development, the physical development of the genital tract was altered in ways we can just talk about, and also the behavior. So they had, less, if a male was between two females, he was less likely to mount females and less likely to copulate. So there was a direct, readout of the fetal position by the behavior in these rodents, which was pretty astounding. And that's still the same message we have today. Very small amounts of chemicals that can alter hormones in early development, change behavior and sexuality and reproductive health.
And what about the brain? Because I'm seeing more and more concern about exposure to these chemicals altering our brains.
Well, Cheryl, as you know, both the genitals and the brain depend on having enough testosterone in place at the critical period for sexual differentiation. And the brain, like the genitals, does sexually differentiate and is different in males and females. I think there's no doubt about that. There's certainly a big role of the social environment on behavior, but there's also a biological factor here, and that is laid down very early in fetal development. So when you interfere with the masculinization of the genitals or the brain in early pregnancy, you induce changes which play out either in reproductive health or behavioral changes. And in our study, we showed that when the mother had higher levels of certain phthalates, those that most likely to lower androgen, lower testosterone, then, first of all, the boys had genitals that were not completely masculinized. And then when we asked the mother about how the boy played at 4 years of age, they were more likely to play in a less male typical manner. And I know this is controversial for some people who feel that play is socially determined. It is in part socially determined. And we actually adjusted for the woman's and her husband's or partner's attitude toward atypical play in their child. But there is also a biological component, which we showed.
This may not be very politically correct these days, but when I was looking into this and having interviews in my second book, I interviewed these people, these young people who had their genders were affected, and it could go back to what it's the chromosomes are even affected, so it's affecting gender, or you can be born without clear differentiation of genitalia and creates all this sexual identity issues or the feminization of males. As we see this becoming a political issue in that community, but what you know, what I think we have to be honest about is a lot of the issues around sexual identity could very well be the result of exposure in utero of these endocrine disrupting chemicals, creating so much confusion in people, but also altering the hormonal levels, or even the representation of their genitalia.
So I would like to, I think I'm going to differ from you in that I don't know that we can make a link between exposure to environmental chemicals and gender identity. And here's why. I think we can make a link between environmental chemicals and disorders of sexual development and homosexual behavior, because we see that in animals. However, gender identity is another phenomena, and we don't know the gender identity of animals. We have no way to determine that. Very little. We have some clues, but that's in the future, and maybe we'll never know that. So I have to say that I'm neutral about the question of whether hormonally active chemicals in the environment is affecting gender identity. However, I do believe that they do play a role, because we see this in animals. In the actual, you know, we see homosexual animals created in the laboratory by chemical exposure. So that definitely can happen, and that could be happening in humans. To the extent that's happening, yes, there's no way to know. So I kind of am less certain than you are, I guess, that about the role that endocrine disrupting chemicals are playing in this question of gender blurring or gender identity, because identity is, you know, feeling that you are in the wrong body, and there is no way that we can ask that of an animal because we don't communicate that way with them. So, you know, I just have to be neutral on that.
I mean, it's just kind of my hypothesis based on just some of the things I've observed. But, you know, obviously you're more of the expert looking at the actual, you know, reality and statistics and validation. But, you know, the point is that exposure to chemicals are affecting us in some very profound ways.
Yes. Yes, definitely.
You know, and that's the most important point. I don't, you know, that's what I really want to get across. So these are chemicals that are used in industries and used in agriculture, used in everyday products. Where are these hormone-disrupting chemicals coming from?
Wow, where are they not coming from, right? I mean, they're everywhere. And a major source is our food, okay? And so I'll give you a little anecdote because I think it's helpful. If you look in the newborn nursery, particularly in the neonatal intensive care nursery, you'll see infants that have a lot of tubes coming into their body. And those tubes are carrying nutrients that the infant needs. And so there have been studies done in Mount Sinai and elsewhere, which has directly related the number of tubes coming into the body to the amount of phthalates in the urine of that infant very soon after that. These things go in and out of the body very quickly. They have a half-life of 4 hours. And so this really demonstrates that when you are taking in nutrients that pass through soft tubing, you will be introducing phthalates into your body. So if you think about where food is processed, how it's processed, how, for example, a milking machine collects milk through a soft, flexible tube, how there are soft, flexible tubes that process sauces and soups and on and on and on. These things all have the ability to draw the phthalate out of the plastic. It enters the food, it goes into the jar or the can, and then it goes into us and it goes into the unborn child and it causes damage. So that's the path that I see, and that's something that we have to interrupt so that that unborn child is not given that exposure. That's one major source. So let me stop there, and then we can talk about others.
you know, as you're talking, is it true that even if something is labeled organic, in the processing of that food or substance, they could have had exposure to those phthalates that then go into the food?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the, yeah. The way to avoid that is to eat unprocessed food to the extent possible. And there have been, and by the way, pesticides also have phthalates in them, and pesticides themselves are endocrine disrupting chemicals. So to the extent that people can eat organic, can afford that, then that will lower their exposure. So ideally, who can do this all the time? We're busy, but ideally, organic unprocessed food is the way to go. And communities that are able to do that, we've shown, have much, basically none of these chemicals in their bodies. So it's possible to get them out. And like I said, quick in, quick out, 4 hours half-life, that's great for these non-persistent chemicals. So if people change their eating habits, particularly if they're trying to conceive or think they might be at risk of conceiving, then it would be a good behavior to adopt.
You know, we're going to talk about some of the solutions, so I'm going to hold off on some of the questions I have. I want to go back to the consequences of hormone disruption exposure to these chemicals on our health. And one of the areas I'm sure you have studied, and I know the Environmental Working Group looked at it, and that's the correlation between exposure to these hormone disrupting chemicals and the obesity epidemic. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Actually, I can't really help much with that, Cheryl, because that's actually not something that I study. There's a wonderful book called Obesogens, and I certainly know that these chemicals do increase the risk of obesity. But as I say, this is not an endpoint that I've studied, and I prefer not to talk about things that I don't have scientific experience with. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. But people can go investigate that as well, because it just comes back to the understanding that we have exposure to these chemicals, these hormone-disrupting chemicals. They're coming into us from all ways and having an impact. And the most vulnerable is the fetus. And maybe we can just mention that, what I know you wrote about this in the book, that what happens when a mother who carries high levels of toxins has a fetus, and what's transferred into the womb. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. By the way, it does not have to be high levels. People think, oh my God, this is going to be so high. No. The levels that we measured, so what I'll just tell you what the setup. I study cohorts of pregnant women. We bring them in, enroll them into our studies. Now we're doing that before they reach 13 weeks so that we can look at early exposure, which is most critical. And we ask them, of course, what they do, what they eat, what they've put on their bodies, all those things. But we don't rely on that to determine exposure. We actually get what we call biomarkers. We measure the chemicals in the woman's urine if it's a non-persistent chemical, a water-soluble chemical, or in their blood to look at the persistent chemicals. So that's sort of the structure of these studies, and there are many such studies all around the world. And then what you do is you wait until the baby's born. You might also look at the relation to timing of delivery, complications of delivery, early fetal health, and newborn health, and then you let the child develop and measure things like rate of growth, and then we go on to neurodevelopment. We also look at skin fold thickness, to look at some of this question of obesity. And in our current study, the children are now about 9 years old, 9, 10 years old, and we hope to continue studying them. So this is a relatively new set of studies, because until 2000, it wasn't really possible to economically measure these chemicals in, thousands of mothers and babies. We also get measures of their exposure when they're children, when they're 1 year old and 4 years old and 6 years old and so on. And so we want to also see how those childhood exposures play in to their later health. So that's kind of the setup. And what we're able to see is that in pretty much every system that we look at, there are effects of these early exposures. And it does seem to be that depending on the system, you know, there might be first trimester versus second trimester, third trimester, but basically in utero exposure is the thing to be most concerned about.
Well, are you seeing the effects of that exposure in these children that are up to 9 years of age now? You noticed anything that's happening?
I mean, I can't tell you about 9 years, but we have behavioral measures when they're 4 and 6. I talked about the play behavior. The fact that that the boys, particularly who were exposed to high levels of phthalates, tend to play in a less male typical manner. That is, they play less often with guns and cars, and more often with dolls and tea sets. And people, like I said, who are concerned about the social influences, which we are also. I point out to them that monkeys, vervet monkeys and rhesus monkeys, actually make those same toy choices. So there definitely is a biological component. But then we also asked the mother about how many words a child knows when they're 30 months of age. That's a sexually dimorphic trait, language acquisition. So girls, as everybody knows, are more facile with language. They learn it more quickly. So the number of words a girl knows at 30 months is greater than a boy knows, right? But we found that that difference between boys and girls in the number of words they know at 30 months is almost completely wiped out under the influence of phthalates. So, and then... Wow. Then other outcomes we've looked at, social responsiveness, which is an interesting measure, which is used in extreme, to diagnose autism spectrum disorder, which we do not do. We don't have that kind of sample size, and that's not a study. But we do look at these measures of various behavioral assessments, which can help us understand how the child is developing and how that's related to their early exposures. And we publish a lot of results on those.
Well, that's so interesting. So can we talk a little bit about what you think are the most important behavioral changes or strategies that we, the population in general, need to start taking to reduce that toxic burden, to help flush or release these endocrine disrupting chemicals out of our body and make sure we don't increase that load?
Yeah. Well, as far as flushing, we don't have to worry about that for water-soluble chemicals because they are flushed out very quickly. And those are largely the chemicals that I've been studying. However, there are persistent chemicals as well, for example, the dioxins, the PCBs, and so on, which are stored in fat. And getting rid of those is much, much more complicated. Again, that's not my area of expertise, and you should have someone else on to talk about that. But they are concerning to me. They're just not anything that I have worked with directly. But as far as action we can take to avoid our exposures, I think the first thing we have to do is to understand the problem. And there's so many people, when I go to talk, I say, how many people here know or have heard of endocrine disruption? Very few hands go up. Very few hands go up. And so I think just talking about this with you and with your listeners and having them ask questions and read about it and hopefully read Countdown, they will educate themselves. We have a lot of resources in Countdown, things they can read further, websites they can go to learn more. And I think education is the really important first step before we can hope for action, because why would people mobilize for action if they don't think there's a problem, right? So I think that's the first step. And then on a personal level, what people can do is they can start paying attention to the kinds of things they bring into their home, right? So they can read labels, which is really important for, say, personal care products. Unfortunately, foods are not labeled. There are phthalate content. You'll never see phthalates in a food or bisphenol A on a food, even though they're going to be in there because they get there through the processing and the packaging. So as I say, using unprocessed foods, and then when you have the food in your house, if you could use glass or ceramic instead of plastic containers, and of course, never, never heat anything in plastic in your microwave, because those phthalates and bisphenol A will hop right out and into your food. And then, you know, try to avoid chemicals in your cleaning products and in your personal care products and in your laundry products and in your sunscreen. And to do that, you can go to several websites that list, you know, you can put in the name of the chemical and get an explanation of what chemicals are in there. And we give those resources in Countdown. So I think, but the big message I want to put out here is pay attention that these things can be risky and we need to minimize our risk. Be concerned. That's the big message.
Absolutely. There's a huge problem happening, and it's happening right in front of our eyes, and we need to be aware. And, you know, it's like it's so big that you can almost miss it because it's everywhere. You know, I remember, I think it's Rutgers that did a study, and they looked at the bisphenol levels of families. And do you know the study I'm talking about? Do you know that study where they they had two families and they measured the bisphenol levels, and they just ate out of the supermarket, and then they had one of the families choose only organic foods, eat only organic foods, and in a week there was a huge difference in the amount of hormones, the endocrine disrupting chemicals they had in their bodies, right?
Yes. I don't know that particular study, but I know of other studies like that. And there's a wonderful book called Slow Death by Rubber Duck. Rick Smith is one of the authors, and he talked to me when he was writing this. He said, well, I want to lower my phthalate levels. What should I do? And I gave him a lot of advice about what he could do, the kind of advice I'm giving to you. And he and his partner had a room set up in which they tried to be chemical free, and they tried to be chemical free in their diet. And they had their levels go plummeting down from most of these chemicals. And then they brought them back up again by going back to their old habits. So yes, definitely you can make a change. On the other hand, I would just kind of caution that the changes that occur in utero are not reversible. So the changes in your adult life, yes, definitely. Stop smoking. That'll bring your sperm count back up. Stop doing X, Y, and Z. It'll increase your fertility. Definitely. Before you go for assisted reproductive technology, try to live a clean life and clean up your act, because that makes a difference. A number of studies out of Harvard have shown that. But whatever happened in the womb is not going to change.
Wow, that's such a powerful message. So it really is important for parents to spend, you know, I was told at least six to 12 months before they conceive to clean up their bodies, their environment, prepare themselves as best they can before they conceive and carry a child, and, you know, in utero environment.
Right. But let me just add, so men, it takes men 60 to 90 days to make a sperm. And in that period, that sperm can be affected by these exposures. And that does affect the development of the child. That has been shown. Okay. However, there are also, as you pointed out, with respect to DES, changes that were actually set in motion several generations ago. So while the parents can do a lot in the period before they actually conceive a child, some things, the older exposures, if you will, the historical exposures may be playing a role, and that is not reversible.
Wow. And as we're talking about exposure, I guess we also need to understand that the quality of our air and the purity of the air in our home is important if you have all these outgassing of chemicals. So, you know, doing something to purify your home environment, whether it's an air purifier or just having lots of plants in the home that help to absorb chemicals. What are your thoughts about that, and what do you recommend?
I think that's really important, and I think using a good filter on your vacuum and vacuuming often and leaving your shoes at the door, all of that makes a difference. And, you know, yes, our air, our water, worry about your water. In my home, we actually distill our water. It's easy to do that. You can filter your water. So everything that you're exposed to, by every means, try to be careful. Try to be aware of the risks it can convey.
You know, you're just doing such an important mission here in bringing this serious issue to our awareness. And I really am so grateful to you, Dr. Swan, because I know this is a passion, and as you share the ramifications and awakening people to the consequences from exposure, you know, we're lifting the veil, so to speak, that
right.
has been affecting health and fertility and well-being, longevity. I just had one other thought, and I know we're kind of coming to the end. What impact does your research have on industry? Because this is all from industry that are using these chemicals and putting them into the environment. Do you see any hope?
Well, I think I have to see hope because the alternative is too grim. And I think that... Well, people should be aware that many of these chemicals are made from petroleum byproducts. And so the, you know, industrial implications are huge, not only for these chemicals we're talking about, but of course also climate change. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, as a society, we are looking at very big changes, aren't we? We're facing the fact that we have very big changes to make. And so one of those changes is going to be to swap out the chemicals that are hormonally active, the endocrine disrupting chemicals. We have to swap those out for alternatives that do not have these harmful effects. And I think this can be done if there's enough pressure to do that. And at the same time, the chemicals that are put into commerce have to be tested before they go into our bodies, okay? Right now, that's not the case. An industry can put a chemical out there. It's not controlled. People think, oh, the government looks after this. We're safe. No, no. The FDA does well with drugs, but the chemicals that go into our everyday products are not screened. And there are thousands of them that have never been tested. So we really need to get on this as a society and pressure our government to control these properly.
So I would think that's part of your mission, is you're bringing this awareness to the world, because I know there's huge interest. I've seen you pop up everywhere these days, Dr. Swan. Everyone is quoting you and quoting your book, and we really want to mention that your book is so important. So I'd like people to get the book, Countdown, How Our Modern World is Threatening Sperm Counts, Altering Male and Female Reproductive Development, and Imperiling the Future of the Human Race. It's a long subtitle, but it says it all. You know, getting educated is the first step of really getting empowered to make the changes. If we, as you said earlier, if we don't understand the enormity of this problem, how it's affecting all of life, we won't be passionate about making the changes. So get educated. You know, so much a part of my show is getting empowered with this knowledge. So your book is so important. So let's just talk about what you feel is so important about the message you have in your book, what people will learn in the book, and then we can talk about your petition that you are now being helping to spread and to make changes, to have an impact.
Well, I think that the book is, of course, I think it's important. I wrote it because I think it's important. And I think that people have read it agree that it's important for them personally. So many people have said that and thanked me and thanked my co-writer, Stacy Colino, who was wonderful. And by the way, the book is not grim, right? I mean, the book has a lot of humor, has a lot of light touches. And Stacy is a wonderful writer and makes this very accessible to people. So don't feel like you're going to be wading through, pages of scientific jargon. Not at all. It's very understandable. And I think it may make you feel empowered because that's what we want to do. We want to help people understand this is an important message. This is a serious past that we've come to, and we can do something about it. And that's what I'm trying to do with the book and with our next steps on the campaign.
Well, it's a clarion call for action. It's like Silent Spring, right? It's
the
modern version of Silent Spring. You're bringing this to our awareness. And I would imagine that book is available everywhere, Amazon and all the other major booksellers.
Yep.
Let's talk about the petition you're putting together.
Well, actually, it's not a petition so much as it is people raising their hands to say me too, right, in a different kind of way. It's using a hashtag, count me in. And if you put that on your social media, you're expressing your support of the messages of Countdown. And then we are beginning an education campaign in a couple months that will help to spread the message. So right now what people can do, buy the book, write a review if you like it, or even if you don't, write what you don't like about it, and use Count Me in your social media.
Great. So in the next couple of minutes that we have before our show has to come to an end, what is it that you would like to say that either to conclude or something that you feel you haven't mentioned that's important?
Oh, well, Cheryl, I wanted to thank you, I think, and for all you do to help people, lead healthier lives, help women lead healthier lives. And, women have been blamed for poor reproductive health for so long. Men have always blamed women. Men haven't taken responsibility for their part in this. So I think that part of what we're doing is empowering women to, say, this is something that we're all concerned about, men and women. And I hope this will also lead to, supporting women in this effort.
Absolutely. And I just really want to thank you, Dr. Swan. I know that you have put your heart and soul into this work and into the book. You really are on a global mission that is so important at this moment in our existence. And you're doing such a beautiful job, and I just want to thank you and encourage you to keep going because you are making a difference, and it's, you have the research and the credibility to get people to really pay attention and to listen to your message. So I am very grateful that you are doing this work and have taken upon yourself and colleagues to really help raise the alarm and to give hope and practical strategies so we can really turn this around and create a healthier and more fertile world. So thank you for everything you do.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye now. And thank you, Dr. Shauna Swan, for the great work she's been doing. Thank you all for listening to What Women Must Know. I hope you'll be joining me every week for these really important and empowering conversations. And until next week, may you always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.